Hey everybody, you just downloaded a special episode of Forge the Narrative. In this episode, we talked to acclaimed voice actor Zach Hanks. He's been in just about every video game that you might have played in the last several years or so. This episode is not about tabletop games specifically, but it's about his experience in the industry and some anecdotes that he's got along the way for voicing certain things like Dawn of War Retribution and directing on some of these titles as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoy what he has to say, and I want to give him a big thanks again for sitting down with us. This episode is also brought to you by Sable Designs with the Army Transport Bags. I just recently picked one up. It's going to be for my new travel bag to take on planes with me, and I'm really excited to use it.
The Narrative.
Hey, everybody. You're listening to Forge the Narrative, and I'm Paul Murphy, your host. I have the privilege of introducing you to Zach Hanks.
Zach, hello, everybody.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Zach is a voice actor who you probably wouldn't pick him out of a lineup, but you've certainly been in contact with him through your Xbox or other video game console. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is almost a coincidence that you were involved in two of the Dawn of War video games that we're talking. And you've done so many great things. The last thing that I know of, anyway, was playing the Pendleton Twins in Dishonored.
Those guys were such dirtbags. That was incredibly, incredibly fun. I was going through, not that you asked for an anecdote, but who would I be?
No, please.
If I didn't roll with the one. I was going through I was grateful to be employed, you know, with some of the other games that I was doing at the time, but I was going through a really boring streak in terms of casting. I play a lot of soldiers. I do a lot of Call of Duty, Medal of Honor, that sort of stuff. And you can only yell grenade incoming so many times before you start wondering, really, what am I doing with my life? And with these games, because of various shifts in the industry, I sort of went from being kind of a lead main character player to sort of playing Marine number two and Navy SEAL number four over and over again, which for a non-celebrity video game actor is really pretty normal, and they pay the same. They all pay the same.
That's comforting to any aspiring voice actors out there.
I suppose. But it does get boring. And eventually you're like, you know, you're sort of hungry for some dialogue. I got hungry for some dialogue with some meat in it. And the dialogue for Dishonored was great. The Pendleton Twins were the skeeviest, nastiest, perverted dirtbags I'd ever had the privilege of playing. And it was great fun getting to, give the player a really strong motivation to kill the hell out of them.
But, you know, I play probably two or three video games, role-playing video games, a year at the most. My wife is 40K. All the other games are like my mistresses. So I have to kind of sneak away from 40K to come and play these other video games. And Dishonored was one I had to have. I really liked the concept. The graphics looked awesome. And for anybody who doesn't know, you play an assassin and you can go through the game in various different ways. And one of the ways is sneaking around and being super quiet and eavesdropping on all the NPCs in the whole world. You played two of the assassin targets.
Right.
And therefore had a lot of interesting dialogue for literally if someone wanted to, they could just sit in the shadows and listen to these creepy dudes talk for quite a long time.
Well, and the context is really colorful too, because it's not just that they're like skeevy, creepy dudes. They are Johns in a Victorian era, but steampunk world brothel. So you eavesdrop on at least one, maybe both of these guys interacting with prostitutes, interacting with courtesans. And that's really where the skeevy comes from, is hearing these guys negotiating, planning, sort of deciding how the erotic role play is going to go, and drinking and complaining about and gossiping about people, and it's a dirty setting and a couple of dirty guys, and it's really colorful.
During that process, did they explain to you, like,
everything about how the scenes could have played out, like the various ways to play through the game.
They made it clear that there were different possible outcomes, and that there, and that I would be providing dialogue for the different possible outcomes. So they had to explain each context very clearly. That's one of the things that sets interactive game dialogue apart from typical linear entertainment dialogue. Like, you're doing a movie or you're doing a TV show or a play, and you go from point A to point B to point C to point D to point E from the beginning to the end. It's a linear story, and you just follow it, you know, cause and effect, beginning to end.
With sure.
A video game, though, it's not necessarily linear. It's an interactive medium, and you're not a passive observer. You're an active participant. So you get to make choices that change the story. It's essentially like, you know, growing up in the 80s, it's a choose your own adventure book. Or it's like the movie Clue, where you get to sort of decide which ending in the theater you're going to go see.
And you just dated yourself and me.
Both of us. There's going to be thousands of listeners going, what?
Yeah, what on earth are they talking about? It's all in the same DVD, you know?
Exactly. Why would you go see the movie in the theater three different times? So when I'm looking at a page of dialogue, and I'm looking essentially at a list of one-shot lines, and the director has to explain, okay, so in this context, the assassin has been spotted. This line reflects the fact that you spotted him. Okay. In this context, the assassin has not been spotted, and you're still conversing with the courtesan, and you haven't noticed it. Okay, now the assassin has stabbed you, and you're responding to this. Okay, now this context, you have actually successfully fought off and killed the assassin, and now here's your line. So it's not like you're sort of like get into an arc and follow that arc. What you're doing is you're creating specific, discrete little moments for the different possible contexts that could be created by the player's choices.
That's
how it goes.
When you're acting like that, and when the director's setting the scene, in this situation, specifically with the voice acting, do they have other people in there acting opposite you, or is it a recorded track? Is it all in the theater of the mind? How does that normally work? I mean, I said I have the privilege of I play through these scenes, and I it was very convincing, you know, when your guys killed me the first time, and when I killed you the second time. But how was that set up in the studio?
Okay, in general, with video game voice recording, you're alone. Even if you're in a dialogue, you're usually recording your part of the dialogue by yourself. And in older games, this created some pretty significant problems. Partially because there were not necessarily as many like seasoned directors out there that sort of knew how to follow the dialogue and knew how to make sure that it sounded like two people having a real conversation. Also, you didn't have the advantage of you know, certain advances in technology that we have now, which I'll describe. But I recall playing Blizzard Entertainment's Warcraft 3. What was the first one? Reign of Chaos or something? I don't remember. Whatever the first work, the original Warcraft 3 was before the Frozen Throne.
Sure.
And I listened to a conversation between the two kind of big badass night elf hero characters, the priestess and the sort of centaur guy. And there was a bit of dialogue that they exchanged where they emphasized they stressed the wrong words in their line of dialogue, and made it obvious that one character was not listening to the other character. If he had been listening, he wouldn't have emphasized that word. It made no sense. It was sort of the equivalent of in fantasy games, someone walking into a room and going, so which one of you adventurers journeyed to Marwyn's Keep? And the adventurer replies, we journeyed to Marwyn's Keep.
I gotcha. Okay, yeah. I follow.
What?
Yeah.
And so things like that would sort of happen. Now, it doesn't happen nearly as often anymore because we're just much more careful. However, there are some games where you do get multiple actors in a room. It's because of the way that actor union contracts are set up. It can be much more complicated and expensive to record multiple actors at the same time, and you tend to get through a lot less dialogue. You do have the benefit of really organic conversations, but the downside is it can be more costly. And it can be more time consuming. There is one advance in the technology that is really exciting. There are some programs where, let's say, you and I are voice actors and you and I are gonna record on different days. So you go in on Tuesday, I'm gonna go in on Thursday, and you record your half of the dialogue. And this all gets incorporated into a piece of software that edits and cues up all of your lines of dialogue into my script. So that when I come in on Thursday, they just have to do like two mouse clicks and they can play your line of dialogue and I can in real time immediately respond to it and have it be recorded. So essentially I get to have a conversation with an actor that's not there. But I can have a conversation with his spoken lines. And that's really cool.
Yeah.
Fun. It makes it much more organic.
You had mentioned that now more of kind of the screen stars are starting to lend their voices to some of these video games.
Huh?
Is that because they're just all super excited about it and want to do it? Or is there just, more... is it easier to get into it now than maybe it used to be? Or is the money just so big they can't refuse it? How is that all happening? And then how do you feel about that?
It's, I think it really depends on the project and on the actor. You know, I will make a generalization and assumption in a moment, but I don't think I can make a generalization or an assumption on that. I think there's some actors who do it because it sounds fun, or celebrities who do it because it sounds fun, but they certainly don't do it for union scale. They do it for their quote, and their agent negotiates a fat check for them. So no one's doing it for the love of the work.
Just the thrill.
They are, but not just for the love of the work.
I gotcha.
There are a lot of celebrities who just do it for the check. There are some celebrities who sometimes are contracted to do it because they made a deal when they signed on for, say, a movie. Let's say it's licensed product, like you're doing Spider-Man and you're also going to do the voice of the Spider-Man character for the game, where you're just contracted to do it. It's just part of the deal for your $5 million check. You got to do this too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it totally depends on the actor. There are some celebrities who I have worked with, who come into the studio, and they've been paid a fairly fat check, and they're brilliant. They're awesome. You know, they just do a fantastic job. They are committed. They are hardworking. They have fun. They're pleasant to be around. There are some celebrities that I have seen come in that are great people, and you can see why they're great actors on film. Because there is magic going on behind their eyes, but mm-hmm. nothing going on with the voice. And they don't, and so some of these people are great film actors, but not great game actors because they don't have experience in the medium. They play the scene with their eyes because film is essentially a visual art form, but not with their voice. In video games, you got to use your voice.
Yep.
And there are some celebrities who come in for the check and are, and are jerks and who phone it in and make everyone's life uncomfortable and difficult. I've been around, you know, or I've heard stories. I've been around celebrities who behave badly. I've heard stories of celebrities who came in, took one look at the script and saw the mound of dialogue they had to do, threw the script up in the air and said, my agent, you know, told me this was going to be like, and for something, for tens of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
I'm not doing this, and walking out, you know, which is already costing the studio thousands of dollars, just for them to do that. You know, I have heard of, celebrities who are behind the mic who, say they get through their page and then crumple up the page and throw it over their shoulder, basically saying, we won't be doing any retakes.
I see.
Which is incredibly difficult if the celebrity mumbled their lines in sort of traditional movie close-up style, and they're in the middle of a firefight on the beach of Normandy and aren't really interested in hearing the director give them a correction in, that's just context.
Oh, but, don't give too many context clues. I don't want to be getting a call from someone's agent.
but I say this. I don't want to paint celebrities as jerks. They're, you know, there are nice people and jerks the world over. And
oh, yeah. In any profession. Yeah. For real.
And a number of celebrities I've worked with are amazing, great, talented people. Keith David, the late Michael Clark Duncan was a peach. Mila Kunis is a sweetheart. Michael Rapaport is just a good dude. And I've gotten to meet and work with a lot of sort of 80s and 90s celebrities that aren't really commanding a big quote anymore. And I sort of joke that voiceover is where 80s and 90s stars go to die. You know, like cartoons and video games are littered with people that were like recognizable faces in the 80s and 90s.
Every now and then I'll hear a voice and I'm like, I wonder if it's that guy. And I sometimes can't place the name, but I know I've heard the voice.
Yeah. The housekeeper from Different Strokes was a regular, was Mrs. Puff on SpongeBob. Who else? Dwight Schultz, Murdoch from the A-Team.
Yeah.
Is an amazing, one of the most amazing, versatile voice actors I've ever heard. He makes choices. I have no idea where he gets the ideas that he gets for the choices he makes in voiceover, but they're always amazing.
I have to ask one, like, since we're kind of talking about celebrities, I got to ask one fanboy question.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Oh, good enough.
Have you met Luke Skywalker and the Joker?
Mark Hamill.
Yeah, I know.
I've never worked with Mark Hamill. I've never met Mark. I am a huge fan. The Empire Strikes Back was the first movie I ever saw. I saw it in the theater. I think I was 2 or 3 years old. The Joker in Batman the Animated Series, his portrayal, I think, is one of the truly great portrayals of that character from, you know, American pop cultural mythology. It is, I don't think it's good. I don't think it's really good. I think it is truly, truly a brilliant creation.
I agree. 100%. Yeah. There was that brief period of time after the Muppets where you didn't see him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then he appeared as the Joker. And then once you learned it was the Joker, not that the Joker itself didn't command its own respect, and I say that not as a DC fan, but once you found out that it was this hero
from your childhood, yeah,
it's like, oh, I have to pay attention now, and in every one of his performances made it worth it.
The main characters in Batman the Animated Series were very, very well cast. The person who directs and casts the DC animated, the animated DC, films and television series is usually, a woman named Andrea Romano, who is an excellent director. I worked with her on, Diablo 3. She directed, the dialogue for Diablo 3, and man, she was just great to work with. And I had actually auditioned for her before. I was a finalist for the role of, I think I was a finalist. I know I got a callback. I think I was in contention, like serious contention for the role of Batman in, Batman the Brave and the Bold.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the latest versions. And the role went to, Dietrich Bader, who is a fantastic actor and a very prolific voice actor. And, believe me, I don't like losing out on roles, but I'm proud to lose out on roles to great people.
Oh, for sure. And then also just to be in contention for some of these things that you know that there's a lot of importance on, that they really are paying attention to the details. Like, they can't just find anyone. They're looking for that specific person. And just to be close to it for a role like that, and I think is awesome.
It's very flattering and exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking through you. I mean, you've been in really just about anything that I would have gone out of my way to play in the last, you know, 5-6 years or so. And that sound, I mean, that's really neat. I will say, though, that the characters you've played, I've probably killed.
Especially in the Call of Duty game. I have played so many red shirts. I've been shot, stabbed, punched, thrown, burned alive, fallen from a great height, blown up, melted by acid, electrocuted, choked, drowned, you name it.
And now, in
all of those things, every single one of them, in Aliens Colonial Marines. The whole.
Well, that's a good question, though, is do you have to, are you the voice of all those catastrophes that happen to your character, or do they mix that in later?
Oh, you know, I mean, like,
how does all the death and the carnage work?
Yeah, you do your own pain sounds. Sometimes they call, because they're nonverbal sounds, I often call them nonverbal sounds. For movies, they sometimes call that stuff walla. Because in the old days, when they had to create background conversation for a scene, they get a bunch of people together in a studio and have them say walla 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 walla. So they call it walla sometimes. I've heard it called a pain bank, because it's a bank of pain sounds. I tend to call them nonverbal sounds, or sometimes they call them the screams and shouts, or the grunts and groans, or whatever, pain sound. And typically they will have us do a separate, bank of sounds for each character we voice for a game. So if I voice like 3 different Marines in a game, they'll want a bank of sounds for each Marine, which sometimes is a little redundant. even though I will try to create a different voice for every character I play, screams and grunts and shouts tend to not vary much.
So do you have a go-to place for the gurgle that one gets stabbed in the throat for? I don't know. It's like,
I do.
How different can that be?
I do. I actually do.
Okay.
What they imagine is that, oh, well, he needs to do it as in the Marine number 2 voice and then the Marine number 4 voice. But when you get down to like screams and grunts and chokes, there's not really much variation. You know, like, you know, my line of dialogue for this guy may have this voice, and for this guy may have this voice, but their screams and grunts will be almost identical.
Oh, yeah, and please pardon my ignorance. That's why the source of the question was, I wondered if they made you do that, or whether or not they, for the speed of time, because a lot of these, you know, are obviously on a deadline and whatnot, if they did have this bank that, to the untrained ear, doesn't recognize that it's been the same gurgle.
Sort of like how they insert the Wilhelm scream into every action movie. You know, it's like it just sort of comes from an audio bank of MP3s, and then you just pluck them out and put them in.
No. Oh, right. And I'm happy it doesn't. Like, I'm real happy your answer is what it is. That's cool, because these are movies. I mean, these are pieces of art that people spend lots of time with. So, sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's fine. I'm glad you appreciate it. I hate it. It hurts like hell. But, you know, we always have to do the screams and grunts at the end, because it, you know, you're hoarse, and, or maybe, you know, completely blown out by the end. But it's pretty rough on the old pipes. Video game voice acting is, you know, I call it the Marine Corps or the NFL of, the best analogy is the NFL of voiceover. Because you, you know, an NFL player, you know, does what they do, they love it, they love the check. But they know that in their 40s or 50s, they're going to be walking with a walker.
Yeah.
They're going to get injured. And that's pretty much how it is with video games. I'm actually presenting a lecture at the Voice and Speech Teacher, Voice and Speech Trainers Association conference in Minneapolis, this summer, about video game voice acting. And I'm couching it in the idea of it being vocal stunt work. That pain and injury is necessary. Well, not necessary, but pretty much inevitable. Kind of like, you know, stuntmen and professional athletes.
Do you equate that to them just asking so much of you because you have to transfer everything through your voice?
It's really more the sort of extremeness of the character types with regard to things like creature voices and the extremeness of the situations in terms of action and violence. So by the extremeness of the character types, I mean like on a TV show, I'm pretty much always going to use my own voice. For a video game, you know, I might be voicing an orc, you know, I'll eat your face. And that is not comfortable to make that sound.
Yeah.
It's fun and it sounds awesome, but it is, but guttural, throaty, raspy, gravelly, textured sounds like for orcs and dragons and ogres are rough. They're rough on the pipes. And then it's the other issue is the extremeness of the situations. Is that I'm yelling grenade incoming at the top of my lungs in a firefight to try to save my own ass and the asses of my friends who are in a foxhole, and that, you know, that mortar round is coming in and I go, grenade! And it you can't fake it. You have to do it. And you also can't rely on sort of good breath support and vocal technique for the stage like they teach you in acting school. Because that mic is right up there and it can tell if you're using your voice in a way that preserves it, you know, like a clear tone, which would sound something like grenade.
Sure. What?
Grenade versus a textured scream, which would sound more like grenade. And maybe you can hear a little bit of strain. The mic has the sound of strain. And if you don't give the strain, it's not good enough for them. So. It's the nature of the beast.
It shows, though. I mean, some of these games, I mean, you feel like I felt like I've been on a journey through some of these games.
Yeah.
And part of that is because it's been painted with such texture in every aspect of it, even things you don't necessarily realize. I mean, that's why, like, headphones are becoming, I mean, they're so expensive now because people are starting to want to appreciate all those little bits of sound that maybe we forgot about.
A lot of work goes into the audio. A lot of work, a lot of detail. The music, the sound effects, and the voice acting. And I'm glad that people are going the extra mile to enjoy what goes into the audio. Because audio used to get short shrift and compared to the visual. You know, it's like, oh, graphics, you know, and rendering. And it's the audio is just stunning. You know, for some of these games. And, yeah.
Oh, when you can hear literally people creeping up behind you, you know, it just builds all this tension.
Yeah.
And then when you do things like you hear, I mean, I know that you're sick of the grenade, but like when you hear it, you react, you know, and watch it. I do it. My 11-year-old does it and everybody in between does it. And that's because it's being sold. So, I mean, you know, conveyed so well,
yeah,
by you guys. I mean, it's awesome.
Very visceral and very gritty. And that's really, you know, I think the difference between video game voice acting as character voicing versus animation, voice acting is that animation is And a lot of voice actors don't know this. And this is usually, you know, when I teach my classes, one of the first things that I, one of the first points I try to get across is that there are two different styles. Animation is character acting for comedy for young audiences. Video games is character acting for drama for adults. And as far as like the sort of pain and injury and strain, there are some interesting accounts from celebrity movie stars who do video games or have done video games expressing how challenging they found it. And I remember either reading or hearing an interview with Christian Bale, who I guess voiced Batman in a Batman video game of one of his movies. And he comments on how painful and difficult it was for him to do this voice. But in a game where there's not a boom mic like right there where he can sort of be quiet and subtle, but the film close-up creates the intensity, he has to actually do that voice and yell in that voice for, you know, dozens or hundreds of lines at one time, which you don't really do in a film. And there's another account, and I think it's actually a video, it might be on YouTube, of Gary Oldman being interviewed for, I think, his work in maybe one of the Call of Duty games. And he comments on how incredibly strenuous it is. And I'm sort of sitting, and hey, all props to both of these guys. They are brilliant. I am a fan, and I love them. But my ego loves to, like, hear that from them. This is hard. And sort of sit back in my chair and go, rookies.
No, this is one of the, everyone thinks that they can act.
Yeah.
And to some degree, people can, you know, get across things like charades and whatnot. I mean, I think that's pretty common. But to really act in a way that it doesn't seem like acting to the people that are viewing it is incredibly difficult. And it seems like it would be even more difficult to not have these things that you're talking about to help support your performance to your audience. So I can respect what you're saying.
Acting is like, it's like a 600-pound deadlift. It's very simple, but it is not very easy.
Yeah, just pick it up. That's right.
Yeah. It's not easy at all.
Go ahead.
Thing about acting is that the people that are very good at it make it look easy, and in that illusion of ease and simplicity, it gives a lot of people the impression that it is easy because it looks easy, and so they think they can do it, and hopefully they discover very quickly that it looks easy. Because the people that are good at it, the Gary Oldmans and the Christian Bales and all these people, because of their mastery, not because the work is easy.
Well, and these people, sometimes they completely transform themselves for each role that they play.
Yeah, like the Gary Oldmans of the world and character actors.
But it may be easy to forget they've got a whole team of people on that set that help them do that too.
Yep.
And it doesn't sound like that you guys doing the voice acting have that support staff to make those transformations.
We have a very different process. I come from a theater and film and television background. Specifically, I guess a theater and film background. I have to admit I didn't really do TV until after I was already doing voiceover. So I come from theater and film, and in theater and film, there's a lot of prep. You know, you get your script long ahead of time, you read the whole thing, you learn about your character, and you practice, and you learn your lines in advance. You know who you are, you know, when you show up on set or in rehearsal. You spend a lot of time on it, you know, weeks and weeks. Video games, oftentimes you walk in the door and you have no idea who you're playing. Sometimes you don't even know what the game is because of confidentiality concerns. You know, you go in to do code name Willow, and you show up and you're like, "What? I have no idea."
Is that how Star Wars was in some of these other like big names?
Yeah, absolutely. I auditioned for something for, I knew that it was a Lucas show. It was animated. They needed voice actors for it. And it was codenamed something. And there were two characters, you know, they might have been named like Jack and Sam, for all I knew. But when you read it, you're like, Jack is a bounty hunter. And Sam mostly howls and is covered in hair. Who could these guys possibly be?
That's funny. That is funny.
Very often they try to hide it, but if you're a nerd, if you're a geek, or a gamer, or a comic book person, you put the pieces together. I auditioned for the character of Tias, whose enemy was, I can't remember, who often referred to this other character named Orcus, who was asleep but was enduring something called the Orcus Sleep. And he was fighting a big hulking ogre from another world that they called the Abomination. Theus was Thor, the Orcus Sleep was the Odin Sleep, and Abomination was Hulk. I was basically auditioning for the straight-to-DVD animated Hulk versus series, which was Hulk versus Thor and Hulk.
Those are good movies.
They're awesome. The voice acting is extraordinary in those, and they cast it right. They got the right people. They got Fred Tatasciore, who always voices the Hulk. They got Steve Bloom, who always voices Wolverine. They didn't try to recast. They got the iconic voices for these people, and they just knocked it out of the park. And Nolan North's Deadpool is brilliant and hilarious. Nolan should always play Deadpool. He's so funny. Nolan is the voice of a lot of things, but he's the voice of the lead guy in the Uncharted series. Nathan Drake. He's the voice of Nathan Drake.
While you're talking about getting the same people to play the same roles, let me tell you something, if I can, that like I would have protested for and it really irritated me when they tried to get a different voice for Optimus Prime.
Do not get me started. Like you, I grew up with Transformers. I grew up with Peter Cullen. He was my Optimus Prime. He was my narrator on Voltron. He was my Venger in Dungeons & Dragons, the animated series.
Yeah.
And the idea that they would, I mean, it wasn't the character of Optimus Prime that made him magic. It wasn't the look. It wasn't what he did. It was Peter.
No,
I remember reading an interview with him where he said that it basically patterned it after kind of an incredibly moral and ethical John Wayne. Optimus Prime is basically a martyr John Wayne who would give his life for any of his friends or to do the right thing.
You just blew my mind.
And that's what Optimus and that's the other reason why Optimus Prime was such a great character, is because he's so noble. He's so good. He never thinks twice about doing the right thing or making the sacrifice that needed to be made. And Peter Cullen embodied that. And his voice is so unique and has this incredible texture. The thought of trying to replace him with a movie celebrity is abominable and foolish, and the very definition of hubris.
That would have been a great wrong that would have had to have been avenged in some fashion.
Yeah, and you know, and casting Hugo Weaving as Megatron was, and I think Hugo Weaving did a great job doing a job basically 5 minutes that we talked about. Once the portrayal of a character is truly iconic, it can't be replaced without some kind of a full-on reboot. There will never be a Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz that is better than Judy Garland, unless you somehow reboot the whole style. You can't capture the style of Transformers with a new Megatron. You just can't, despite what a great job Hugo Weaving did. It's a great performance. But it's not good enough because it's not Frank Welker. And that's it.
Charles
Adler was a great Starscream. But, well, I have to admit, truth be told, they had no other choice. The actor who played Starscream is no longer, who originally played Starscream, is no longer with us. But you get what I'm getting at. You know, like, once Steve Bloom has been established as the voice of Wolverine, or Fred Tatasciore has been established as the voice of Hulk, it's very, very difficult to replace it and have the fans accept it because it's Hulk. You just don't reinterpret it. You know, it's Wolverine. You just don't reinterpret it, like, once it's iconic. Props to my pal, Rick Wasserman, who did Hulk in the Planet Hulk cartoon. It was a reimagining of Hulk, where Hulk is very intelligent, and he did a great job.
Okay. I buy all these movies because I try to support the art, and when a comic book movie comes out, I try to pick it up in the store.
A lot of them are really good, man. A lot of them.
I've liked them all. I even get most of the DC ones. I'm not a DC fan. I mean, let me say the DC does some amazing cartoon movies.
They do.
And TV shows. They got it down. They got it nailed. They have it nailed down. Or they got it nailed down way sooner than Marvel did.
They do until they start, I'm going to censor myself, star effing. And granted, some of the celebrities are really good. But when they replace an iconic voice for the celebrity with the assumption that the celebrity is gonna sell more units, they are not only making a creative mistake, but they are making a sales mistake.
Oh man, are you not talking about Nathan Fillion, are you?
No, I'm not. Fillion for being a card carrying geek.
That's what I was. That was going to be my point. I was like, some of these people are true. It seemed to be. You know, I mean, granted, they're actors. They could be selling us any bill of goods. I don't feel like that's the case, though, but I know it's not. I can sense that or whatever. But it's, you know, I do like it when the nerds get to do the nerdy things.
Case in point is Adam Baldwin and Anne Hesch as Superman and Lois Lane in the Death of Superman straight to DVD, where Superman fights Doomsday.
Mm-hmm.
Great actors both. But it's Warner Brothers, it's DC. We already have voices for these characters, and we recognize voices for those characters.
Yeah, that came out in the time when the cartoons were still in the air, right? Like the Justice League.
I think so.
Or at least it wasn't too far removed from memory. I don't think.
I think so. It would be like Warner Brothers doing a DC, you know, cartoon, doing a Batman. That is not a stylistic reboot, because The Death of Superman is not a stylistic reboot at all.
No, they've been milking that same style for quite some time. I don't mean I like it. Like, what was the original Batman series? The first the Batman cartoon that spawned the Superman cartoon that eventually spawned the Justice League cartoon.
It was Batman the Animated Series with Kevin Conroy as Batman.
Yeah, that's great. Granted, it's probably different, but in my mind's eye, it's the same style, and it's awesome for what it is.
I think. I'm not sure. But yeah, you get my point. And I could.
Yeah.
I don't want to fill up your podcast with this rant, but.
Oh, no. I mean, it's
fill up your podcast with this rant.
this stuff is, you know, it's definitely, I think it resonates, because you're talking about the details that matter a lot to basically the people that would go out of their way to download a podcast.
Yeah.
So I definitely, and I enjoy hearing it, and it matters to me too. And some of this stuff, it changes my perspective on how I view some of these things, because I'm a purist at heart, and I'm also kind of the opinion, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. And if I get attached to your character, you know, the character in X thinks Superman, the guy or whatever, I think that the people producing it have an obligation to maintain my expectations if they want to keep getting my dollars.
Yeah. The it's the suits. The directors get it. The casting people get it. The actors get it. It's the studio executives and producers, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, that don't get it. They see a celebrity's name and they see dollar signs, and they think that because it translates that way in film and television, that it translates that way in animated media. And they dismiss the power of geek fandom. They dismiss the power of cult followings. Every time it happens, I feel like I feel like I'm getting a wedgie from the football team. I really
sure.
do. I feel like I'm a geek and I'm not being understood by a cool kid in a nice suit. By a popular kid in a nice suit, who's telling me that he knows better. and it not only disappoints me, but to an extent it offends me, because I sort of feel like with trying to reboot the voice of Optimus Prime, it feels like a slap in the face.
It really is. It's they're betraying the nostalgia that got them to the movie deal in the first place.
Yeah. And it's
they're making the movie, not the actor getting the role or whatever.
Right. And I recognize that it's not just the fanboys that are the only people that are going to be buying tickets to see Transformers, but the kids and parents who are buying tickets to see Transformers will not be going because Optimus Prime is voiced by George Clooney. They're not going to go to the movie and go, wow, George Clooney. They're going to go, wow, Optimus Prime. It doesn't matter. You know, to attaching a celebrity name to an animated character, most of the time, I don't think it matters. With a few exceptions, and that's when the celebrity shines through the performance so brightly that it becomes self-referential. Case in point, Robin Williams as the genie in Aladdin, or Gilbert Gottfried as the parrot in Aladdin.
Eddie Murphy is the donkey.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy, and Mike Myers is Shrek. In those cases, yeah. We actually are going to hear them. But the Shrek series is one of the most some of the most rampant star effing I've seen.
To stop you for just one second, can you think of a non-original character, like the one that had an established voice and person behind it, that has benefited from a celebrity? Like a big time screen celebrity coming to voice. And I don't want to put you on the spot. There may not be one. I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Question. Let's see. I'm trying to limit myself to animated media.
Yeah, there may not be one.
I can't think of any, but if I think of it, I'll hop on IMDb and do some digging.
All right. And I want to state that I don't think there have been celebrities who have done good jobs in roles. And I've certainly, sometimes I like it when I pick their voice out, like without knowing that they're in there. You know, it's kind of like an Easter egg, even though it's not really an Easter egg. But I'm totally with you on changing things just for the sake of change that can really, in my opinion, and you may not share, but it's a betrayal of the fan base that got them to the point to where they could even do with the project that they're doing now.
It is, but they only care about the dollar signs. My argument is that I don't think it affects the dollar signs the way that the suits think it does.
I'll buy that. Let me ask you one last question, and try to bring everything back around. We mentioned that several times you've been part of these iconic properties, I guess, you know, like Star Wars and Final Fantasy and things, Captain America.
Of our cultural mythology.
Oh, right. How much mileage of that do you get out of with your friends and family?
Let's see. With my family, none. They love me and are proud of my success. But for them, they're not geeks like I am. They're not fanboys like I am. You know, so the excitement of getting to voice Cyclops or getting to voice characters that are now literally immortalized as Star Wars canon. You know, Garnak from Clone Wars is now part of Star Wars lore. Like, it's not just a thing that happened in a cartoon episode. It's now part of the legend. You know, it really happened and affected events that led to Luke and Leia's birth. So they're not the kind of people whose jaws hit the floor over geek coolness of that.
Sure.
With friends, some, you know, it's a novelty.
Oh, and I don't mean necessarily like perks. I just mean, how often do either they bring it up or do you get to work in something that's like, haha, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
family never. Friends, it's a very occasional novelty. You know, like, hey, dude, I heard you in so-and-so. Oh, cool, thanks. Or, hey, I saw you on Criminal Minds. Oh, cool. My Criminal Minds episode runs, like, constantly. So I get seen a lot in that. But it carries more mileage with my students here at the university.
We didn't mention that earlier. You're at the University of...
I am currently a visiting assistant professor in the School of Theater at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas. It's in Deep East Texas. I teach beginning acting, theater speech, advanced theater speech, which is basically Shakespeare, dialects, theater appreciation, and off curriculum. I teach voice acting technique, although I am going to develop a class that will be a 4-credit class, and clowning, which is ridiculous fun. And now voice acting is something that I do on the side as opposed to something that is like my full-time career. But with regard to what I mentioned about my students, it's really their generation that has grown up with video games that are heavily narrative based, that have compelling stories, realistic graphics and sound, and are filled with good voice acting. So iconic characters are more a part of their pop cultural mythology, from video game characters, than even our generation, yours and mine. So it carries more weight with them. It's I tell my friends that, hey, I was so-and-so in a Call of Duty game, and they're like, oh man, that's really cool. That sounds like fun. Oh yeah, I heard you the other day. But with this next generation, their jaws hit the floor, especially when they find out it's their professor. Which is great for me, because then they listen when I try to teach them about Greek tragedy and why it matters. So it's sort of, I believe me, I name and project and character drop like the hackiest of Hollywood hacks.
I don't think that I could resist on some of these either.
It's the thing that I like the most about it is that it gets them listening. Like, I tell them that, and it gives me some credibility, so they listen to me when I talk about acting or voice or whatever, theater history. And I will admit, my ego does love the occasional stroking, and now that I'm not in the biz full time, and I don't have the reassurance of the sort of, quote, somebody-ness of being in a lot of big name games all the time, I do occasionally name drop to reassure myself that I'm still, or at least at one time, was sort of a capital S somebody.
Well, your last credit that I see is from 2012. This is not exactly ancient history.
No, but I see that every actor thinks that their last job is going to be their last. And I really thought I'll never do a video game again. And I just did one, and I think I have two more coming up. But it feels that way. It feels that way.
Sure.
And that's one of the things about transitioning from the profession into academia is this sort of lurking fear of becoming irrelevant, and of my points of view becoming dated. You know, of telling someone, well, son, let me tell you how it is in the real world, how it is in the business, and then finding out, oh, it's not that way anymore. and then wondering, am I now a fraud? So
I think you've got at least another year before you have to worry about being a fraud.
I got at least 6 more months in.
At least. No, I'm just joking, of course. I'm sure that will not be the case for quite some time.
I sure hope not. did you have any questions about the Dawn of War 2 games or anything like that? I know we talked about it before.
Well, you know, I just more of a note. I play Catechins in the game. So when I saw, you know, that, like, man, we've got a connection. You know?
That was actually a funny thing. The interesting little bit of trivia about that. Two things. One, online, I was mistaken for Steve Bloom, who is the voice of Wolverine and Spike Spiegel from Cowboy Bebop. And
that's good company, then.
I couldn't be more proud than
yeah.
mistaken for Steve Bloom. But the other bit of trivia is they wanted to pattern the voice of the Catechins after the performance of Clint Eastwood in the movie, oh God, what was it? Gunnery Sergeant Highway from the movie. Oh no, help me out with this. Where he's a Marine.
I know it's just the one. It's like, you know, when it's your time, there's no, can't, no matter how fast you run or where you hide. Is it that one?
Well, it's I remember he has the line. He's in, you know, someone is smoking a, you know, an equipment like supply depot guy is offering him contraband Cuban cigars. You know, he's like, we get Cuban cigars over here if you ever want one. And Clint Eastwood looks at him and says, if you don't get that contraband out of my face, I'm going to stick it so far up your ass, you're going to have to stick a match down your throat to light it.
Or all right.
Something like that. And it's called, I can't remember. But anyway.
I feel like I've seen it. I feel like I've seen, you know, every Eastwood movie up until a certain point.
I remember hearing he had, like, throat cancer or something. And they wanted his voice to be that. So it was just super rough, gnarly voice. But hard, but fun to do.
Well, the Catechins, I mean, I'm sure you know what they look like, but they're a bunch of little Rambos.
That's right.
On tabletop.
Like, dressed like Rambo.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And when they first came out, people considered them like the worst figures ever made by Games Workshop.
They're ugly little guys.
Because, well, their arms are bigger than Space Marine arms. And that's kind of why I got into it. I'm like, you know what? I like Rambo as a kid, and people seem to want to buy these and then unload them for 25 cents a piece. Now, this was like a long time ago. You don't get these deals anymore. But people have come to grips with the figure. That's why I have an army of Catechins, because at the time, they were super cheap, and I like Rambo.
They have, I love the fact that they're basically built like 80s bodybuilders.
Oh, yeah, and they've got the faces like they're, yeah. It's exactly like they're trying to lift that 600-pound weight we were talking about earlier.
Do you or your listeners have any interest in some trivia about some of the voices from Dawn of War 2 and the characters that they, or the different troop types that they played?
I'm sure that yes.
Let me throw a little bit at you from what I can remember. Thaddeus, who is the we're in the Space Marines now. Thaddeus, who is the Space Marine with the jump pack. What are they called?
Assault Marines.
Assault Marines, that's right. He's the voice of the Assault Marines, and Thaddeus is Philip Anthony Rodriguez, who is the voice of one of the dads on Secret Life of the American Teenager. The voice of who's the heavy weapons Marine that has the...
Devastators.
Devastators. Voice of the Devastator is James Horan, who is one of the sort of top 10 villains in the Highlander franchise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
From the TV series?
From the TV series, yeah.
He was okay.
But he's done a whole lot of other work since then. Really neat guy.
I don't know anyone who's in the middle of the road on Highlander. Either they love it, or it's, you know, it might as well, it's geek repellent to them. You know, I like it. I love it. I mean, of course, I thought the series, the TV series, got sometimes a bit ridiculous. And certainly the last movie or two was terrible.
As a dialect coach, and a student of dialects, the casting of the first Highlander movie makes my head explode. Christopher Lambert, who is, I believe, what is he, a Frenchman?
Yes. I think so, yes. I believe he is.
Is playing a Scotsman. So they cast a Scotsman, Sean Connery, to play the Spaniard.
Right.
The Highlander's other Scotsman enemy, played by the Kurgan, played by an American, Clancy Brown. Also, by the way, a very prolific voice actor and a very cool dude.
And yeah, that's one of those ones that I always pick out because he's in one of my favorite movies, Buckaroo Banzai.
That's right. He's the voice of Lex Luthor and a whole bunch of other stuff. So yeah, it makes my head completely explode. The Tarkus, who is the voice of the, what are the sort of standard Marines?
Tactical squad. Tac Marine.
The voice of the Tac Marine, the Dreadnought, most of the Orcs, the Bloodletters, the Great Unclean One, and I think that's it, is Fred Tatasciore, who is the voice of the Incredible Hulk in animated series and most video games, with the exception of Planet Hulk, but Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes, and also the movie, The Incredible Hulk with Ed Norton. It's credited as Lou Ferrigno. He got the credit.
Hmm.
But from what I heard, Fred Tatasciore did the work.
Now, I know that you embrace this culture, but do these other people, I mean, how wide is that? Do most of them? Do just a few of them?
Oh, do you mean the voice actors?
Yeah, the actors.
It's different for different folks. I think the video game and animation people, well, particularly the video game people, are, they're pretty nerdy. They're a pretty nerdy bunch. I don't know that they're as sort of gamer geeky. Some of us are. But not all. I know that,
I'm just curious, you know, if there is a growing number, because it seems like, you know, especially things like the Nerdist channel and the Geek and Sundry and whatnot, that there's just more of us out there now.
You're talking about the Nerdist?
Yeah, the Nerdist and Geek and Sundry and whatnot. It's
right.
Yeah. Chris Hardwick.
Okay. Chris Hardwick's girlfriend is Chloe, who is the half elf rogue in my D&D campaign. So
we gotta hang out at some point. That's all.
We are a horrible big pack of nerds. Actually, a lot of the video game people, now that I think about it, are D&D nerds. Liam, God, I hope I have his last name right. Liam O'Brien, Matt Mercer, Talison Jaffe, obviously myself, Jason Marsden. Jason Marsden is a Magic player. Phil Lamar, who is, the Green Lantern. And
so that name sounds really familiar. And
he's probably Samurai Jack. He's a character on Futurama. He's the guy who gets, shot in the face in the car in Pulp Fiction. And he was on Mad TV for many years.
Yeah.
Great dude. Phil Lamar's a D&D guy, and a comic book guy.
You're not outing these guys, are you? I don't know.
They're card-carrying nerds.
So, hey, that sounds good, yeah.
You know, Vin Diesel and Stephen Colbert and Rainn Wilson are all D&D guys.
That interview with Vin Diesel when he was like, you know, when I bought my Unauthor Arcana, they said I might have been a D&D player or whatever. Like, like that, I appreciated that. It's like, he definitely had his nerd cred from then on for me.
A lot of us did, you know. He lent us some serious credibility.
Because that was before it was super popular. I mean, like, now you can get away with saying that.
Yeah.
And I don't think at that time it was anywhere near as accepted as it is now.
Even you know, my theater geek friends in undergrad thought gaming was weird and nerdy. I got them into it, but they thought it was weird and nerdy. My theater students, all of them either already play or are dying to play. And they're all gamers. They're all anime fans. They're all cartoon fans. They wear shirts with their favorite cartoon characters on them from Cartoon Network. The culture is, the nerds have completely inherited the earth. And it is a great time to be a geek.
I think so, yeah. And I don't know, how are we supposed to refer to ourselves now? As nerds or geeks? Does it matter?
It's sort of like how...
Is it regional?
What's sort of like how different kinds of gamers want to be clear about what kind of gamers they are. Like, oh, no, I'm a video gamer. I don't play D&D. Oh, I'm a tabletop guy. I'm not a LARPer. You know, like oh, I'm not a LARPer. I'm a cosplay.
Don't say the L word.
And then every single one of them, LARPers, cosplayers, anime people, video gamers, tabletop people, all of them together, band together and go, no, we are so not into furries. They're like at the rock bottom of what they are, the untouchables.
I have a buddy who worked at a comic shop, and he would tell me about the guys that would come in and buy the furry comics, and they were basically all, they were the lower rung.
They were the very bottom rung.
Yeah. That's.
And to
call it like it is, they probably know people that they consider the lower rung.
And those people are the plushies. Which I think is like some kind of sexual paraphilia. With regard to your question, I've heard or read that there are actually specific definitions for nerd, geek, and dork. And that's why I keep correcting myself when I say nerds and I go, no, I mean geeks. I think that nerds are like sort of the bookish, like science and math kind of minded
so
people.
They're the dungeon masters. And the geeks are everyone else, is that where you're going?
I think the geeks are the gamers. The geeks are the gamers and the comic book people. The geeks are the fanboys. The nerds are like the sort of the Poindexters and the super smart people. And I have no idea what the dorks are. But I remember there's like some kind of classification. So, yeah.
Well, hey, this is, I know I said that last question is my last question, but I'll ask you this other last question, if you've got time, if you don't mind.
Oh, before you do that,
yep.
I've got a little more trivia for you.
Oh, please. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't digress so much.
I just remembered it. The Plague Marine in the game is Tom Kane, who is the voice of the Oscars, and Yoda.
Oh, wow.
Trying to think.
Plague Marines are also near and dear to my heart.
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't love a little Nurgle?
Right.
The voice of the scout, of the Space Marine scout, is Steve Bloom, who is the voice of Wolverine and Spike Spiegel from Cowboy Bebop. And let's see, trying to think if there's any other people I can think of that are sort of, I don't know, I'm sure I'm forgetting some people, but those are the first ones that come to mind that I figured that tabletop 40K gamers.
That's still pretty cool. Around. I mean, that's to know that they've got, all that nerd cred, boiled down into their performances. Yeah, it's next time I realize that I'm listening, it's going to make it more entertaining.
There's a YouTube video. If you look up Dawn of War 2 voice actors, we compiled a YouTube video of all the voice actors from Retribution, and footage of them voicing their characters and introducing themselves as themselves, but also introducing their characters in their character voices. And it's kind of neat listening to them morph. So what was your other question?
Oh my goodness. I think I've forgotten it.
Sorry.
Oh no. What is the moment that you can remember that you have geeked out the most? Either in like some kind of fanboy situation, you met somebody, you were in a situation, it was the first grenade you ever had to duck out of, out of the way of or whatever.
I worked, my waiting tables days, I worked as a host at Yamashiro, which is like a hot sort of a hot spot for dinner and drinks in Hollywood. It has like, it's supposed to be one of the best views in LA. And I was younger and celebrities would show up and I would geek out a little bit. And some of them were super nice. Like, I think Eric McCormick could not have been nicer. And some really wanted me to go away. Alanis Morissette really wanted me to go away. When I was like, you know, I was like, here's your table, enjoy your meal. Also, just want to say, I love your work. And she scowled. And I was like, oh, damn. And it was these experiences that taught me that celebrities, most of them really desperately want to be ignored. When they're in public, they really want you to ignore their
thing. I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah. I remember when I started working in voiceover and meeting celebrities because I was directing games, you know, I met Michael Clarke Duncan. He was super nice. Keith David was fairly sort of quiet at the start, but after he kind of got warmed up after yelling and screaming in his session for Saints Row, he, you know, the endorphins were flowing and he was chatty and, you know, we had a really nice talk and he was really nice. And, but the first person that I really geeked out over, and I feel terrible because I can't remember her name. I think it's Mary something, but she played one of the housekeepers on Different Strokes. And, I had recorded her for a SpongeBob game because she was playing Mrs. Puff. It wasn't Mrs. Garrett. It was the other one. And I took her aside and I said, look, I just wanted to say to you, and I hadn't seen her on TV or film for like a decade or longer. I said, I just wanted to tell you, you know, I meet a lot of recognizable faces and like A-listers and stuff. And I don't get starstruck. It's neat, but I don't get starstruck. I want you to know that I am starstruck meeting you. And she sort of got teary-eyed and she was really, really flattered. And I said, you were a part of my childhood. And thank you. Like I was a little boy and I loved watching you and the other characters from Different Strokes and you are great to me. Thank you. You know, and I think she found it quite moving, or she seemed quite moved. The other people that I tend to geek out over a little bit are people that are voices from my childhood cartoons. I would geek out over Peter Cullen in a huge way.
Yeah.
I geeked out a little bit to become friends with Michael Bell, who was the voice of the Parquet Margarine Tub.
Mary Jo Catlett is the...
That's right, Mary Jo Catlett. Oh, she was such a sweetheart. Such a sweetheart. I geeked out over meeting, and then actually ending up becoming kind of friends and colleagues with Michael Bell. And, you know, starting to meet these different voice actors and putting the pieces together and going, oh my God, Greg Berger, you're Grimlock from Transformers. You're the Tyrannosaurus Rex Transformer. You know, and, trying to think of other like cool people, you know, Brett Ratner, excuse me. Not the director guy, but, the movie trailer guy who is the voice of Flint from the original G.I. Joe series.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
And I went to a meeting about like a union meeting at his house or the house of a friend of his or something and meeting him and being like, you're Flint. You're awesome. Thank you. You made my childhood better for your work. So I get starstruck over people that were a part of my childhood. So yeah, I would flip out. Oh, I'm sure I would flip out over Mark Hamill. I would flip out over Peter Cullen. I would probably flip out over Frank Welker. I will say the first casting director I ever met, made a connection with, turned out to be the voice of Papa Smurf. which totally blew my mind.
God, yeah, it's really cool to I mean, because you think of Papa Smurf as a singular individual, and but then to meet someone who's been a part of that and something else, something else, something else, something else.
Yeah.
You know, it's just neat. You don't always think about it because you're so attached to a specific character.
Yeah. He also was
the, as a fan.
Yeah. He also was the voice of the obnoxious, student who asked all the questions in, the lecture in Young Frankenstein. isn't it true, you know, that, and getting into his, you know, reanimating dead tissue roots. One last little anecdote about my childhood voice heroes, which I cannot tell you how sort of grateful I am to, as an adult and as an actor and as a professional, to get to like rub shoulders with, meet, and like quite legitimately become actual colleagues of these people. And like now be Facebook friends with all of them. And not even as a fanboy, but as like a colleague still blows my mind. And I don't
think. Oh, yeah. You made it to peer status with some of this stuff. It's really cool. It's an accomplishment, but I respect it.
Yeah. You know, I would say colleague. I know how you mean the word peer, but something to me, I just don't, their body of work is still so far beyond what I probably will ever achieve. I sort of keep them on a certain degree of a pedestal. But, I have a friend who actually was a student of mine, not a college student, but a professional voiceover, video game voice acting student, who, I found out some things about his personal history that really blew my mind. And he's a little bit younger than me, but he's sort of he's still in the same general, generation, kind of Gen X, Gen Y. And, he told a story, and he's a voice actor and a big sort of geek fanboy of 80s toys and cartoons and stuff like that. And he told a story. I think he might have posted it actually on like a social media network or something about how he grew up in an abusive household and how he had been abused by his father. And how sort of lonely his life was and sort of traumatizing and traumatic it was. And there was no one there to teach him how to be a responsible man with integrity. And I'm trying not to get choked up as I say this, but he grew into a responsible man with integrity, with an angry streak, but with powerful self-control and a deep sense of right and wrong. And he was taught by several surrogate fathers. And he talks about it in his post. The surrogate fathers were He-Man, Superman, Batman, Flint, Hawk, Optimus Prime, maybe Dungeon Master. All of the sort of iconic good guys from the Saturday morning cartoons of our youth that frankly only existed to get people watching commercials to push toys.
But God, that's thinking about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These cartoons were draws to get people to watch advertising and advertisements themselves for licensed product.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the cartoon itself is the licensed product and the toys were the main thing.
There were some that came into existence simply to sell toys but the toys were never far behind even the ones that weren't necessarily.
Yeah.
Made that way.
Sort of a chicken or the egg kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what gets me about this is that these were ads for toys, these cartoons. And yet this man, his life was changed, nurtured, in a way, saved by these cartoons. And they were saved by the men who played these roles and cared. cared enough to make them good, to sort of honor these characters and give, and not just phone it in, but give them life and make them matter. You know, like, thank God for Peter Cullen for giving us a pop culture mythic hero that is worth emulating in Optimus Prime. You know, a true sort of heroic icon that young people can look to and go, I can be, I should be like that. I want to be like that. You know,
to instill a clear right and wrong. Like, it's very, yeah, I hear what you're saying exactly.
Yeah. And real sort of noble ideals that are not wrapped in, religious dogma or magic and mysticism or ego and power and money games, but just, you know, and that's one to grow on. And that's half the battle, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
What did you say at the end of G.I. Joe? Is that who it was? And that's half the battle?
And knowing is half the battle.
It's half the battle. So they didn't have to put a moral in at the end. Oh, like, that's...
Yeah?
I dig it. And I'm grateful to have participated in being the next phase in that lineage.
I think you're right there. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And then after you do a few more of these epics, come talk to me again, please.
I will try. And I'll pretend that I never directed Saints Row or Bratz. For, you know, games.
Bratz? The Bratz? Is that?
Games, you know, here I am painting a picture of being like a part of this noble lineage of sages guiding our young men into manhood, when in fact I spend an enormous amount of my time directing projects for which I will probably burn in hell.
Yeah, you may be right. But yeah, you're having fun doing it.
I certainly do. I certainly
do. Well, Zach, thanks a lot for taking the time with me tonight. I really had a good time doing this, and the anecdotes, the insights, all very entertaining to me.
Oh, cool, man. I'm glad you dug it. I hope it's fun for people that are into this sort of stuff.
I can't imagine it's not. That's what, you know, what we were talking about before, is that these details you don't always just get. And it's nice to hear, and it makes something that's important to somebody even more real. So thanks for sharing it with me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Have a good night.
All right, man. Take care.
Strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.